Chapter 18. The shipwrecked crew. Next day was the 24th of July, and the 24th of July in the southern hemisphere corresponds to the 24th of January in the northern. The 56th degree of latitude had been left behind. The similar parallel in northern Europe runs through Edinburgh. The thermometer kept steadily below freezing, so that the machinery was called upon to furnish a little artificial heat in the cabins. Although the days begin to lengthen after the 21st day of June in the southern hemisphere, yet the advance of the albatross towards the pole more than neutralized this increase, and consequently the daylight became very short. There was thus very little to be seen. At nighttime the cold became very keen, but as there was no scarcity of clothing on board, the colleagues, well wrapped up, remained a good deal on deck thinking over their plans of escape, and watching for an opportunity. Little was seen of Robber, since the high words that had been exchanged in the Timbuktu country, the engineer had left off speaking to his prisoners. Franklin seldom came out of the cookhouse, where Tapich treated him most hospitably, on condition that he acted as his assistant. This position was not without its advantages, and the Negro, with his master's permission, very willingly accepted it. Shut up in the galley, he saw nothing of what was passing outside, and might even consider himself beyond the reach of danger. He was, in fact, very like the ostrich, not only in his stomach, but in his folly. But whither went the albatross? Was she in midwinter bound for the southern seas or continents round the pole? In this icy atmosphere, even granting that the elements of the batteries were unaffected by such frost, would not all the crew succumb to a horrible death from the cold? That Robber should attempt to cross the pole in the warm season was bad enough, but to attempt such a thing in the depth of the winter night would be the act of a madman. Thus reasoned the president and secretary of the Weldon Institute. Now they had been brought to the end of the continent of the New World, which is still America, although it does not belong to the United States. What was this intractable Robber going to do? Had not the time arrived for them to end the voyage by blowing up the ship? It was noticed that during the 24th of July the engineer had frequent consultations with his mate. He and Tom Turner kept constant watch on the barometer, not so much to keep themselves informed of the height at which they were traveling, as to be on the lookout for a change in the weather. Evidently some indications had been observed, of which it was necessary to make careful note. Uncle Prudent also remarked that Robber had been taking stock of the provisions and stores, and everything seemed to show that he was contemplating turning back. Turning back, said Phil Evans. But where to? Where he can reprovision the ship, said Uncle Prudent. That ought to be in some lonely island in the Pacific with a colony of scoundrels worthy of their chief. That is what I think. I fancy he is going west, and with the speed he can get up it would not take him long to get home. But we should not be able to put our plan into execution. If we get there, we shall not get there. The colleagues had partly guessed the engineer's intentions. During the day it became no longer doubtful that when the albatross reached the confines of the Antarctic Sea her course was to be changed. When the ice has formed about Cape Horn the lower regions of the Pacific are covered with ice fields and icebergs. The floes then form an impenetrable barrier to the strongest ships and the boldest navigators. Of course, by increasing the speed of her wings the albatross could clear the mountains of ice accumulated on the ocean as she could the mountains of Earth on the polar continent, if it is a continent that forms the cap of the southern pole. But would she attempt it in the middle of the polar night, in an atmosphere of 60 below freezing? After as he had advanced about 100 miles to the south the albatross headed westerly, as if for some unknown island of the Pacific. Beneath her stretched the liquid plain between Asia and America. The waters now had assumed that singular color which has earned for them the name of the Milky Sea. In the half-shadow, which the enfeebled rays of the sun were unable to dissipate, the surface of the Pacific was a milky white. It seemed like a vast snowfield, whose undulations were imperceptible at such a height. If the sea had been solidified by the cold, and converted into an immense ice field, its aspect could not have been much different. They knew that the phenomenon was produced by myriads of luminous particles of phosphorescent corpuscles, but it was surprising to come across such an opalescent mass beyond the limits of the Indian Ocean. Suddenly the barometer fell, after keeping somewhat high during the earlier hours of the day. Evidently the indications were such as a shipmaster might feel anxious at, though the master of an aeronef might despise them. There was every sign that a terrible storm had recently raged in the Pacific. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon, when Tom Turner came up to the engineer and said, "Do you see that black spot on the horizon, sir? There away to due north of us? That is not a rock." "No, Tom, there is no land out there." "Then it must be a ship or a boat." Uncle Prudent and Phil Evans, who were in the bow, looked in the direction pointed out by the mate. Robert asked for the glass and attentively observed the object. "It is a boat," said he, "and there are some men in it."
"Shipwrecked?"
asked Tom.
"Yes.
They have had to abandon their ship, and, knowing nothing of the nearest land, are perhaps dying of hunger and thirst. Well, it shall not be said that the Lubatris did not come to their help." The orders were given, and the aeronef began to sink towards the sea. At 300 yards from it the descent was stopped, and the propellers drove ahead full speed towards the north. It was a boat. Her sail flapped against the mast as she rose and fell on the waves. There was no wind, and she was making no progress. Doubtless there was no one on board with strength enough left to work the oars. In the boat were 5 men asleep or helpless, if they were not dead. The Lubatris had arrived above them, and slowly descended. On the boat's stern was the name of the ship to which she belonged, the Jeannette of Nantes.
"Hallo, there!"
shouted Turner, loud enough for the men to hear, for the boat was only 80 feet below him. There was no answer.
"Fire a gun," said Robber.
The gun was fired, and the report rang out over the sea. One of the men looked up feebly. His eyes were haggard, and his face was that of a skeleton. As he caught sight of the Lubatris he made a gesture as of fear.
"Don't be afraid," said Robber in French, "we have come to help you."
"Who are you?"
"We belong to the Barconette, and I am the mate. We left her a fortnight ago as she was sinking. We have no water and no food."
The 4 other men had now sat up. Wan and exhausted, in a terrible state of emaciation, they lifted their hands towards the Lubatris.
"Look out!" shouted Robber.
A line was let down, and a pail of fresh water was lowered into the boat. The men snatched at it, and drank it with an eagerness awful to see.
"Bread, bread!" they exclaimed.
Immediately a basket with some food, and 5 pints of coffee descended towards them. The mate with difficulty restrained them in their ravenousness.
"Where are we?"
asked the mate at last.
50 miles from the Chile coast and the Chonos archipelago," answered Robert.
"Thanks. But we are becalmed, and we are going to tow you."
"Who are you?"
"People who are glad to be of assistance to you," said Robert. The mate understood that the incognito was to be respected. "But had the flying machine sufficient power to tow them through the water?"
"Yes,
and the boat, attached to 100 feet of rope, began to move off towards the east. At 10 o'clock at night the Yell and was sighted, or rather they could see the lights which indicated its position. This rescue from the sky had come just in time for the survivors of the Jeannette, and they had good reason to believe it miraculous. When they had been taken to the mouth of the channel leading among the Chonos Islands, Robert shouted to them to cast off the tow line. This, with many a blessing to those who had saved them, they did, and the Lubatris headed out to the offing. Certainly there was some good in this aeronef, which could thus help those who were lost at sea. What balloon, perfect as it might be, would be able to perform such a service?
and between themselves Uncle Prudent and Phil Evans could not but admire it, although they were quite disposed to deny the evidence of their senses. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.